That's a birdie.
My name's Randy Parsons. I'm a very grateful and at this moment a very humble alcoholic.
Hey, Randy! Hey, Randy.
Man, y'all don't know what it's like. There's a power in this room that's unreal. Whew. Y'all give me a chance to kind of catch my breath. Those of you who want to, you better take a picture quick, because you may never see me in a coat and tie again. I guarantee you. That is suspenders on. Boy, Mama and Daddy, this one's for you, because y'all wondered what this AA thing was about. And this is what it's about. This is from a Mom and Daddy who are not here tonight, but they're visiting with us, I guarantee you, somewhere floating in this room. You know, I always wonder what I'm going to say, what I'm going to do, or whatever. And boy, I really wonder tonight. I spoke in a lot of places in front of a lot of people. I ain't never spoke in front of a bunch of guys that look better than you do right now in my life. This place is something special because you guys are here. You know, I live about 40 miles up the road and I can come down here anytime. But when you ain't here, this power ain't here. It's with you wherever you are. In your home groups, in your homes, wherever you live, you know. Well, I had four or five things I was going to say and really set y'all afire, you know, and get you going. And I was walking around back yonder a while ago. I thought, you know, about that guy said he felt like he was a cat in a rocking chair factory. I was about that nervous. And this little prayer that I found somewhere came to me, and so I'm going to read it to you from me. I do not ask for mighty words to leave the crowd impressed. Lord, grant my life may ring so true, my neighbor may be blessed. You know, I tell you, when I read that, I started thinking about you guys, and you're the reason that I'm here. I do want to say something about the... About a year ago, Kip Collins spoke down here, and I need to tell you this right quick. He shared something in his story about a guy he had sponsored for a good while, and that guy went to the doctor, and the doctor gave him a bottle full of pills because he had a little back trouble. And I never come to these workshops knowing what's going on or what I need to get out of them. I come down here kind of like a sponge, and I just sort of fill up off y'all. But that night, when the end of Kip's talk, I knew why I was here. You see, Kip probably saved my sobriety that night, 1 year ago. Kip told about how that man had came to him and told him the doctor gave me this little bottle of pills. And he said the name of what they were, and it was Vicodin, and I went, oh. And he told that guy, you better throw those pills away. And the guy says, I got back pain. I can't stand it. I got to have it. The doctor said it's okay. And within 1 week, his friend that he'd been sponsoring about 10 years was dead. 3 or 4 days before I came to that workshop, I'd gone to my doctor. I had to call him from the bed that morning, and I couldn't get out of the bed. I couldn't stand up. I crawled to the bathroom to pee to keep from peeing in the bed. Used to just pee in the bed. Y'all done taught me a little something. I called that doctor, and, you know, I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, wait and come to the office. In the meantime, his wife wouldn't let him go to work that day because of his health. So his son was covering. His son doesn't know my story. The doctor that I normally go to do. He calls in a prescription. Guess what it's for? Vicodin. I knew better than to take that medication, and I didn't. But you see, not only am I an alcoholic, but I'm one of them others, too. I got problems other than alcohol. Okay? Conference approved literature. So Kip was talking about that, you know, and I get to thinking, you know, I better get rid of that stuff. But the game had started when the pills were in my possession. Y'all know about the mental obsession. I'm not going to take these pills, but you know, I better keep them. Because one of y'all might need them. you might remember I got them and called me to get them, you know, just in case. And then the other part of that slick game comes in. Well, hell, I didn't pay but about $4 for these with that Medicard I got. You know, I can sell them for about $10 a piece. Shit, I get rich. You know, the drug dealer never goes away. Excuse me. So finally I get home after that workshop, and I'd prayed, guys, the whole way, and I get there, and there's that bottle of pills sitting right there on the desk where I'd moved it from the drawer to the desk to the drawer to the desk. Neil should have thrown them away. Neil should have got rid of them. Doesn't matter that I know what to do. You see, I knew I shouldn't have been doing what I was doing before I ever got here. I got home, and I prayed to that God that I don't understand, who's watched over me my entire life. Didn't start watching over me when I got to AA. And he gave me the courage to throw those pills right down in the toilet there. And y'all guess what I wanted to do? Yeah. Reach in that toilet, get them pills back out, and put them back in that bottle, let them dry. Just in case you might need them sometime, I'd give them to you. It's like keeping that bottle of liquor in the house in case somebody comes by to have a drink that don't drink like I do. I don't know about you. You may be able to do it. I don't need people drinking around me. But my mind will say, how come that somebody can drink? What's wrong with him? He just wants one drink. Anyway, I told you my name's Randy Parsons and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August the 17th, 1991. That may not impress any of y'all. It does, however, impress my family. It does make the streets around here a whole lot safer for you to travel on. And today I know it's by the grace of God. You see, I know I'm sober tonight by the grace of God. No more, no less. I'm learning how to live sober by following the directions in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And listening to how you people put these principles into your life. I know no other way. I'm sure there's 1,000 more ways. They don't work for me. They may work wonderfully for you. Psychiatrists may work for you. Psychologists may work for you. Preachers may work for you. Priests may work for you. Voodoo dolls may work for you. I don't know. This is what works for me. And this is all I got to share. I'm going to make an amends right now, and this came to me this afternoon. I ain't never heard it done before, but I'm going to do it. When I was out there in active addiction or drinking or using or whatever, I always wanted to be things I wasn't. I always wanted to be star football player, basketball player, baseball player, track man, all that. I wanted to be Don Juan or Casanova or something like that. I always wanted to be a hero. I wanted people to have parades for me. I wanted people to think highly of me. Never wanted to do the stuff it takes to get there. You know, I mean, I don't want to go across the seas and be in a war and die and just be a hero. I was going to be the hero, you know. So for those of you who were in the service, I owe you an amends. I abused the honor of what you did for your country. And I lied about being in the service. And I tell people what a wonderful guy I was and how I did all these wonderful things. And I'm not proud of that. And I always wondered how I was going to make that amends. And I hope that you can accept that amends. That you can let me go on and I no longer have to carry that burden today. If you can't forgive me, that's okay too, because I think I've done all I can do. And I don't have to lie about it anymore. You know, today I'm just another drunk just like you that hopefully has found a new way to live. Enough of that. My drinking started when it started. Probably 2 or 3 years old, best I can remember. Something clicked in me with alcohol at about 2.5 years old, and I drank out of my daddy's tall Budweiser. I don't remember getting drunk every day at that time. I don't remember craving alcohol. I don't remember having strange and weird parties. Probably was still peeing on myself, but you know. Something clicked. I believe this book, every word in this book, I don't doubt any of this book today. And it tells me that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Alcohol, from then on through my life, until I found you people in AA, there was always something special. Even the people who were drunks just fascinated me. You know, I mean, they're living in squalor. And they can't work. And their clothes are nasty. And they smell. And I was fascinated. Wow. Got to be great. You know, Creighton's sitting over there, and I got to tell you all this, too. I'll get around to the store sometime. They told me I had an hour and a half, so don't worry. We'll get it done. I've been blessed with being asked to be the speaker chairperson for the 2002 State Prepaid Convention in Athens, Georgia. I hope y'all can all come visit with us then. So for the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been listening to some daggum good tapes and some powerful messages of recovery. And I pray tonight that I don't get off telling y'all their story. You know, and Creighton, if you hear me start saying I stole a car to go to my first meeting, you say, wait a minute, that's mine. And if I'm laying under that bridge out there and wherever it was where was that? Kansas City. You say, no, that's mine, so keep me back to where I'm at. I guess that tells you I've been listening to your tape, don't it?
That's mine.
But really, guys, you know it's wonderful. And another great thing that's happened to me recently, and hopefully you'll realize how important these things are when I get to telling you a little more. I was asked to be a member of the program committee for this workshop. I never thought I could ever be asked to do anything like that. You talk about an honor and a privilege. I've always done what I was asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor said, anything other than take a drink, you do it. Well, I got hit with a little deal this time that I wasn't prepared for by sponsors or anybody else. You see, they didn't ask me to speak tonight. They just said, you're speaking. And they just printed a piece of paper that said, I'm speaking. You know, so it was kind of a unique thing to me. And I want to thank Bill and the committee and Larry and all you guys. I think I want to thank you. You know, those are powerful things, and they may not mean a lot to you, but they mean an awful lot to me, you know. But back to how I got here, and you know, drinking and drinking and drinking, and like I said, something about alcohol fascinated me. Something about it was just, there was just something about it, and I couldn't wait to get to where I could drink on my own. And by the time I was 13 years old, I was drinking on my own. And I drank as much as I could drink when I could get it and as much as I could get. I didn't have a lot of ways to get it at that time other than stealing it, and that continued with me for the rest of my drinking career. Even when I was working, I'd steal it. I'd steal it just to be stealing it. I guess I was a thief, too. Anyhow, you know, do who? Thought somebody was asking me a question. Oh, does anybody have a topic? Y'all ain't gonna let me get out of this, are you? I think as Cliff Locklear said, they ought to be called listeners' meetings. Because I get talking, oh, y'all gotta listen. Anyhow. You know, the alcohol was just a thing, and by the time I was 13, it was starting to make decisions for me, and the decisions were that I'd drink rather than do what I was supposed to do. And I've never been one to be worried about consequences. You know, I'd drink, I'd get caught drinking, and I'd get, you know, grounded or, you know, locked up in the bedroom or whatever for 18 and a half seconds, and then I was gone again. But my folks and nobody ever, ever said, "Randy, why do you drink?" They just said, "Don't drink." And if somebody's told you when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, "Just don't drink," you tell them politely, "If I could just don't drink, I damn well need to be here." There's a whole lot more to just don't drink. As I got into high school, alcohol became much more important in my life. Also, other drugs entered into there about that time, 15, 16 years old. I loved to stay awake. I loved to talk fast. I loved to drink a lot. And some of them had some little pills that you could get it back in them times. It was solid black. You could take them. They just let you go. So I took a lot of them things. You know, the miracle is I somehow graduated from high school. I played ball in high school. I was a pretty good ball player, evidently. Had several colleges talk to me about playing for them. I wasn't quite as heavy as I am now, in a lot better shape. But I had a resentment at the University of Georgia because it takes too long to explain the whole thing. But suffice it to say that somebody who had more money than my folks had, their son came back to Georgia from a school he got kicked out of and ended up playing on my scholarship. So that was a pretty big resentment until I got sober. Had some other schools ask me to play for them up in North Carolina, Boone, North Carolina, Appalachian State. Asked me to play for them. Couldn't quite go up there, though, because the first thing I saw when I got up there was a no package store. And I asked the guy that was showing me around, I said, "You know, by the way, if a fellow wanted a drink, you know, kind of happenstance, by the way, where would he get one?" And he said, "Oh, you got to go down to Boone. I mean, not Boone. Oh, 13 miles down the road anyhow. 13 miles down there to get a drink." And I said, "I ain't walking that far for no damn body." So you know what I told them they could do with their scholarship. Turned one down at the University of Chattanooga in Tennessee because they had wanted to make me study biology, and I just knew that would be entirely too hard. So I made decisions based on alcohol. But I had no clue that alcohol had any power in my life. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. You know, when I got here, I'd have told you I drank because I liked the taste of it. I liked the taste of this hemp special water, you know, they charge us high price for. I ain't never sat down and drank two cases of it, though. Y'all know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah. I just like the taste of it, you know. What a fragrance and an aroma and what a bouquet. You ever just want to hit somebody when they said that? You know, drink the damn stuff or throw it away. Anyhow. So I kind of, you know, let that make some decisions that changed my life path right there and just began to really just drink, work odd jobs that would suffice to get me to drinking and sort of began back then in the late 60s, a hippie movement, you know, and I'm going back to be one again. But this time, by God, I'm going to remember what I did. I don't remember what I did then, because if you went through the 60s and you remember it, you weren't there. I guarantee you that. So I got involved with the hippie movement, you know, and I mean, that really just set me afire, because people didn't care who you were, where you were from. They just want to know, did you like loud music? Did you like women? Did you like to get loaded? Amen, let's go. You know, what more could you ask for? So I ran around with those people for a good long while and did a lot of crazy things and saw some weird stuff. You know, I don't know if it was real or not, but it sure did look real. I remember one time, I got to tell you this because it was the best beer I ever had in my life. I was down at a little pecan grove down here, the other side of Macon, down there, they call it Byron, I think. And me and another guy went down there. They're supposed to be having a little music festival. And we got down there and we found it. Man, there was about 30,000 people standing around over here, mingling around and all, you know. We thought we had hit home. We wandered around. We was all smoked up, doped up, choked up, puked up, all that. 2 days. We walked across the street to see what was going on over there. There was 300,000 in that field. We were at the wrong place, at the free stage, they called it. Get over there, and over here is where Hendrix and them big name guys were. But that's where I bought the best beer I ever had in my life. I didn't have no beer to drink, didn't have no wine to drink, didn't have no booze to drink. Had all them pills and all that pot, and you know, you get thirsty when you drink it and doing that stuff. This farmer drove down through the middle of them pecan trees, and he had a pickup truck, had the bed lined with plastic, and he had the best Busch Bavarian beer you ever seen in your life, ice down in it. $1.25 a piece back when they were about a quarter. Give me two. You know. Crack them, suck them down, man. Don't it just make your mouth water now? Yeah. But that was the best beer I ever had in my life. Saw a lot of weird stuff down there. Managed to get back home and managed to somehow along about a little later in that time, you know, some little voice in me that's been in there all the time said, Randy, this liquor's killing you. And at that time, I was 20 years old. I was drinking a quart of liquor a day. I was drinking however much beer I could pour down, doing all kind of pills, smoking, whatever, you know, did a whole max. Working about 90 hours a week and just being pretty much crazy and insane. And having a wonderful time doing it. And this little boy said, Randy, that liquor's killing you. And I took heed. I looked around, couldn't figure out where it was coming from. So I quit drinking liquor and didn't drink any liquor at all for 10 years. But you see, I'm good at taking directions. That boy said absolutely nothing about beer. So I just kept drinking a couple of cases of beer a day. You know, I mean, what the heck? Worked in a juke joint up there, you know, and had access to alcohol at all times. They were paying me a high wage at that time. I think they were paying me about $3.50 an hour to drink and talk, and I loved to do both. So I was kind of in hog heaven. But after that boy talked to me, I started wondering, you know, I kind of had this feeling my life was getting a little sideways. Things weren't going quite right, and I decided that what I needed to do was what somebody had told me a long time ago. I needed to get me the right car, the right house, and I needed to get me the right wife. So I got my first ex-wife at the place I found all my ex-wives, in the bar. I mean, you know, might want to consider getting a wife at a church or even a laundromat might be better, you know. Not the bar. You know, at least if you got it at the laundromat, you'd know she'd work. This is a men's workshop. So, well, they're all exes now, so there ain't nothing I can do about it. So anyway, I finally did. I ran up on a friend of mine's girlfriend, and we sort of kind of hooked up. And, you know, I was a man of high moral standards and wouldn't fool with another man's woman. So I don't know how. She must have just took to me and made me marry or something. So we got married, and that marriage was one based on fear, anger, resentment, damage, insecurity. What other words can I use? Sex that I don't remember, was I bad to black out and go, wonder did I get any? Y'all done that, ain't you? Yeah. But anyway, that marriage lasted about 7 years, and I can't lay the blame on her. She was a good woman, and I probably helped her find her way down. She drank a lot like me, but I abused her both mentally, physically, verbally. I'm not proud of that, but I have to own that stuff. I can't sit up here in front of you and say it did not happen. You know, I've always been a great guy. No, I haven't. That marriage fell apart and I went down a little further. Had a pretty good job at that time and managed to drink and drug it up. That was about 1977, and I got to tell you, you know, I found that white powder back in 1971. And back then, you couldn't, you know, now I guarantee you, you could probably walk around this area down here and whistle loud enough, and somebody would come out of somewhere and want to sell you some of that stuff. It's that prevalent. Back then, you really had to work for it, you know, to go get it. And some of them folks that kind of brought it to us, you know, at that time, went to way off down yonder to get it. But I loved it. I loved everything about it. It was better than the amphetamines because it didn't put the edge on me so bad. It still allowed me to drink an awful, awful lot. Made me think I was a lover. You know, only in my own mind. Nobody else's mind, I can guarantee you that. And it became prevalent in my life, and it was a part of the ruination of that first marriage. And kind of got through that marriage and made this decision that my problem was these crazy women that I'd been running around with. Even though I was married to one, I'd been kind of, well, I had women friends that I just visited with on occasion. Two or three times a week, anyway. So, and when I wouldn't go home, and that caused problems. But that marriage fell apart, and my decision was it's women that caused me my trouble. So I said, all right, I just won't fool with women. I'll just drink and drug. That's pretty damn good alcoholic thinking. You know, you get the things in your life that are causing you problems away from you, and you won't have the problems, right? Doesn't that make good sense? Well, it wasn't that, so somehow or another I convinced myself to going back to women again. Continuing with the alcohol and the drugs and got married again to my second ex-wife. Kind of amazing. My second ex-wife had to be more insane than me. Because she lived with my first ex-wife for a while. So she had to be crazier than me to marry me. Or either they really do think they can change her, I don't know. But that marriage kind of went along pretty good, and we both were of a mutual admiration society of each other. We loved Miller Lite. We drank a lot of it. I kind of appreciated her. She didn't care much for them other drugs I did, which meant that I get to do them all. I can buy her a little beer, shuffle her off, and I can do my thing. Problem was, I kept forgetting where I'd shuffled her off to. Two or three days, two or three weeks later, I'd come home, and my stuff would be in one of them daggum boxes out there on the front porch again. And I thought, dang, she cleans up a lot and has to move my stuff. You know, I didn't have a whole lot of stuff either, guys. I mean, I couldn't afford it, I guess. I just kept enough that you could keep in a couple of Miller bottle boxes would hold pretty much everything. They were pretty stable boxes, so you could haul them around, move them different places. Called back one time, I had... I was bad to get... When somebody would dare me to do something, or I was foolish enough to make some kind of statement that I'm going to do something, even if it was the craziest thing in the world, I couldn't let you know that I was wrong in doing it. So I was at work one day and I said, I'm going to Florida. Nobody wanted to go. I'm going to Florida. And the next morning I called my boss, told him I'd be a little bit late to work. I was supposed to be there at 10. I called him about 9 in the morning. He said, well, where are you? And I said, just outside Orlando. I went to Florida. Got caught by a state patrol going down there, running about 80 miles an hour. I'd been drinking all day long, been peeled to the gill, and just had finished one of them fancy bottles of wine. You know, I got on technological kind of wine. You know, I went to this new stuff with screw caps, and y'all still drinking old rotten cork stuff. And I just finished drinking one of them, and he pulled me over for speeding. And the mind goes to thinking. Somebody up there this morning said, "I'm going to jail, I'm going to jail." I'm saying, "How can I not go to jail? How can I not go to jail? How can I not go to jail?" So I get out, walk up at his car, open the front door, sit down in the front seat. He got the prettiest, shiniest pump shotgun sitting right in the middle, runs all the way from the ceiling to the floor, and I'm eyeing this thing and wanting to touch it. Prettiest thing I ever seen. The blessing of that was at that time I still wore, man, I was wearing short hair before Michael Jordan was playing basketball. And I had it all shaved off of about an eighth of an inch. You know, if you're a good drunk, you do that for one reason, because you don't have to have but one towel to dry off. Anyway, short hair, just had got it cut too. And that cop said, "Where you going?" I said, "I'm going fishing. I ain't got nab bit of fishing equipment in there." Praying he don't say, "I want to see your pole." And they having motorcycle week in Daytona. He said, "You ain't going over there with them hippies over there at that damn motorcycle stuff." I whooped that hat off, man, with that short hair, and I said, "I wouldn't be over there with them GD hippies for nothing in the damn world." You know, right where I was heading, Daytona. But, you know, being a good alcoholic, you know we beat the system, right? God allowed me to slip through another knot in the noose. He said, "Boy, if you'll drive right down here about 2 more miles, there's a rest area. If you'll pull over and go to sleep or just stay off the road till sunlight, won't give you a ticket." About a half a mile, I pulled them out there. You know, just doing crazy things like that. And then I spent the next 4 days down there just as miserable as a human being could be. Man, my belly was tore all up, all them pills and that wine mixed with liquor, and I couldn't keep nothing down. I'd take a big old honk and it'd just bubble back up through your nose. Whew, when an alcoholic can't keep his liquor down, he's in trouble. But I hung around, got on back, and there was, looked on the front porch when I come by, and the wife got a broom in her hand. I said, "Boy, I hope she beats me with that." And I seen them boxes. And that gum miller bottle boxes. Y'all know them old deep, they was deep kind, about like that. There they were, right there on the front porch. Go in the house, she don't say nothing. And I don't know what to say. So I'm trying to figure out if I've got any money that I can lie about. I went off and won a bunch of money somewhere. Y'all ever do that? I got to gambling one night, and I went slam broke. I done lost about $8,000. I doing all right until I got to drinking. Somehow or another, when I got to drinking, boy, the cards turned. I blame it. I thought they was cheating me. They may have been. But I come home, and I had maybe $1,000, a little more in my pocket, about 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, how am I going to get out of this? And I done lost $8,000 in a poker game. I took that $1,000 and I throwed it on the bed. "Look what I done won, honey. Cost me $9,000 to get drunk that day." Now, that's a fool. That's crazy. But you see, it all comes around to the fear. The fear that even though this relationship is sick as it can be, I'm going to lose it. They're going to put me out. I'm going to be on my own. I can't live that way. But I couldn't tell you, and I certainly couldn't tell them, that my life has been fear-based and been driven by fear ever since I can remember now. Every decision, every thought, every move I've ever made was based on fear. I told you that I wasn't afraid of anything when I got here. It didn't take me long to admit to you I was afraid of everything. You know, there's a difference in being insane and being unafraid. Got a buddy back there, and he'll understand this. I walk into a dope joint down there just outside of Miami with a little satchel of $250,000 in it and a 9mm pistol in my belt. The only words that me and that man have gotten to say in common are "dose Bud." You know, I could get 2 Budweisers. And what was in that satchel was dinero, and that's it, you know, but we can make a dope deal. And I tell you, I ain't see you. Man, he ain't afraid of nothing. Hell, he's crazy as hell. You couldn't drag me in there today. You know, them people don't even understand English. Even my kind of English. But I'd do it. And then I'd drive all the way back home. No fear. Crazy. Nothing but insanity. Scared to death. That second marriage was another marriage full of violence, threats of violence, anger, hostility, resentment, all those things. That second wife, sex, we must have had it at least one time because I got a daughter and I was hoping to get to her. And I can't deny she's mine because she's got too much, You know, she's got that dimple, never has forgiven me. But that second marriage went the same way, but that wife wouldn't put up with it. She fought back. Whew, did she fight back. And guys, I'll tell you one quick thing. Don't you ever try this if you haven't already done it. Drop kicking the television is okay if it's unplugged. Don't do it when it's plugged up, because I mean balls of fire that big come out of that thing and they'll get you. Anyhow. I went through all that stuff, you know, tearing the windows out of the house and the doors off the hinges. And, you know, I'd go to other folks' house and I'd see where they'd done that. I said, that's a sorry damn rascal to do something like that. You know? And his wife would have a big old black eye and she'd want to say she fell down against the doorknob. You know? And I'd say, that's a sorry rascal who did something like that. And you know who the sorry rascal was? It was me. But I never thought that I did those things. I didn't know. I'd come out of blackouts and things would have happened. Freezers would be turned over in the middle of the kitchen floor and all the food that that wife had worked her little sweet ass off putting up would be laying out there rent and rotting. Yeah, I did it. And I'd asked her, you know, with all sincerity, what in the hell happened? Because I had no idea. People say, man, you know, I would never do that. And I say, you ever been in a blackout? And they say, yeah. I say, you don't know. You don't know if you did the same exact thing because you were in a blackout. Think about that, guys. If you drank to that place like I did, you don't know. If you come up to me tonight and say, Randy, in 1973, you ran me off the road, damn near killed me, I got no way of knowing. So don't say you wouldn't do those things that other people have done. Hopefully you haven't done them yet. That marriage rocked along somehow or another. There must have been sex got involved in it. And a beautiful child was born on January 8, 1985. And as most good expectant fathers, my wife had to call me in a bar and ask me to come to the hospital. She'd been in the hospital probably 2 weeks. There was a lot of complications. Doctor was afraid that if something happened, she'd bleed to death on the way to the hospital. We lived 8 or 10 miles from the hospital. To be honest with you guys, I don't think I ever went to visit her one single time in the hospital during that previous to that child being born. Probably took an extra 30 minutes after she called me, walking around congratulating myself and telling all my good buddies I was going to the hospital to have a baby. Yeah. That's where this disease will take you. That's where it took me. Everything I ever cared about, I gave away. This disease took absolutely nothing from me. Nothing. I gave it away because I was unwilling to do what it took to not do that. I was unwilling to look at me. Saw that baby after she was born for about a minute or two. Everything was okay. Beautiful little girl. Immediately walked into the waiting area of the hospital. It was a Catholic hospital. Some wonderful, sweet nuns run. Walked into the waiting area, laid down in the middle of the floor and passed out. If you think those nuns won't get upset with you, you go try. They'll ask you, don't come back. Because it did me. I ain't proud of those kind of things, guys. But that's where this disease has taken me. That marriage hung on for a little while longer, and probably another year, and my wife had a wreck. In her drinking, I tell this because she's okayed it. She got help from Alcoholics Anonymous the next day. Been sober ever since. On March 4th, she celebrated 13 years continuous sobriety. She needed to get here before I did. She was sicker than I was. Remember that? Married me. She took care of that child, and my disease progressed. I went from where I used to could make a little money with my drinking and my drugging to where I became my biggest customer. I would do whatever it took to stay loaded. I'd become an IV drug user about 84. No, about 81. Swore I'd never do that. I'll never stick a rig in my arm. Didn't want to do it to the gym. But it got me. Took over everything I could do. I mean, I was such a good alcoholic that I'd mix the damn dope with alcohol. Because I couldn't find no water, you know. I mean, you know, you can shoot booze. You can shoot beer. And I'd say, man, it's got bubbles in it. Bubbles will kill you. And the whole time I said, it'll kill you. Just, you know. I'm pretty crazy. But this disease has that power. And you know, I did a lot of crazy things. I lived in squalor. I lived in a house. At that time, I owned 2 houses and 4 acres of land out the road. And I couldn't pay the mortgage on it because all the money was going into me. And I was renting 1 house for enough to pay the mortgage. When I finally let the man have it back that had been so gracious to let me buy it, I cleaned that house up, and there was 42 pounds of empty beer cans on the floor. The reason I know that is because I bagged them up and sold them to get a drink. I was using a 5-gallon bucket for a toilet. I had no running water. I'd wash off with water I'd take out there in gallon jugs. No phone, no heat, no nothing. Tons of dirty syringes all over everywhere. And I didn't have a problem. Called my mama. Thank you, mama. She said, come on home, son. You can clean up and get you another job. And you can stay here 2 weeks. And my mama loved me so much, she almost loved me to death. 5 years after that, I asked her to take me to the hospital. And that's where my recovery began. But I laid up in my mom and daddy's house for another 5 years, drinking liquor and shooting dope, doing whatever I wanted to do, never once thinking about them, never once giving them a nickel, never once giving my daughter anything, never once giving anything to my ex-wife for my daughter. All about self. This disease of self that I suffer from. On August 17, 1991, I walked up the hall at my mom and daddy's house and I asked my mama the strangest question. I said, Mama, will you take me to the hospital? Y'all know what that was, guys. That was a grace of a power much greater than me, doing for me what I could not do for myself. I got on the telephone somehow or another. Don't know how I did it. Don't know how I found the telephone number. I talked to a treatment center in Athens. The guy that answered the phone was a guy that helped to find his bottom. I put enough stuff in him to kill a bunch of people. He was working there. He'd gotten sober. He'd gotten clean. And he said, Randy, why don't you come down and talk to me? And I said, I don't know. I think I got a little problem. He said, well, just come on down and talk. And I said, when? It was 8:45. It was a Saturday morning. I remember it just like right here, right now. He said, come on down at 10. I said, let's make it 11. Y'all know about getting, we got to get ready to go to treatment. Don't want to go in there looking like no doubt. You know, got to get slick. hip and cool and all that stuff somebody was talking about, you know. I had to get myself together. What I was going to try to do was do enough dope, drink enough liquor in that hour to hold me while they talked to me for about 5 hours and fixed me and sent me back home. But this little voice, you know, I don't know about y'all, I had people living in my head and men sitting on my shoulders and, you know, and a lot of folks outside them windows. I didn't go into that. Y'all ever wonder where all them people went to? Y'all done been there, ain't you? I knew it. This old man on this shoulder said, Randy, say you're going up at the hospital and they're going to talk to you about 5 hours. Like I said, they're going to fix you up and send you on home and you're going to be okay. And this little man over here said, boy, you better take all your cigarettes for you. You ain't coming home. Now, I reckon which one of them guys was right. I went into a 28-day program and I walked out there a free man 94 days later. They ran me through that cycle 3 times. Now, I got to where I knew what they was going to do. You know, they did the same thing every 28 days. You know, it ran through a cycle. And I knew what was coming. I said, listen to this. You're going to get something right here. You know, them other people. I'd run in the treatment center then. But you know, guys, I look back and I owe my life to those people there because I was in such physical condition, such bad physical condition, that it's amazing that I'm, I might have could have lived and been here, but I don't really need to know who I am, if that makes any sense. I was leaking more cocaine out of the veins in my arms than most people ever put in them. I drank all the booze I could drink. The dope didn't work. The liquor didn't work. I could not get drunk. I would be legally drunk as far as the law would be concerned, but it did not stop that wave of horror and terror that was coming down that road after me. You know, it didn't work anymore. I don't know about you, but if you drank to that place, you know what I'm talking about. And I don't want to go back there ever again. That hospital saved my life. I think they kept me there as a steady, for a long time. I kept wondering when they'd let me go. People kept getting out. And I thought, well, I've done more work than they've done. Why can't I go? And they said, well, you need to stay a day or two more, you know. And I, okay. All right. But somewhere in that treatment center, I began to get honest and I began to realize the one key thing. Somehow I wanted to live a little bit more than I wanted to die. When I went there, I didn't give a damn. I couldn't stand life as it was anymore. I knew the booze didn't work. I knew the dope didn't work. I didn't know anything else would work. But I couldn't stand to live anymore. I was way since past being capable of doing any kind of decent work. I did menial labor sometimes, you know, and whatnot. But, and I worked in places where drunks can work. And I got, they took me to AA meetings. They took me to NA meetings. And, you know, I still go, I go to any 12-step thing that I need to be at that time. But my recovery I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somehow I got on my knees in that center and I said, God, I don't know who you are. Don't know what you are and I don't know if you are. But if you don't take this old boy right here and do something with him and do something with him pretty quick, I'm checking out. Now, it might mean I was going to check out of that hospital. I was going to check out of this life. You see, my problem has never been, ever been drinking and drugging. My problem has always been I can't live sober. I cannot live in this world that you people have without the use of alcohol and drugs. They work to keep me in this world for a long time. You take that out of me and you leave me in this world, and it's like, ugh, I short out. But I came to you people and I gave myself to you people and I admitted. After that prayer, something happened. That treatment center put me through the steps in their way very quickly. I did my first fifth step 40 days away from a drink. People say, you can't do it. I say, you certainly can. And if you're hurting as damn bad as I was, you'd probably be doing something. You know? Don't say you can't. Don't wait until you feel like taking the steps to do it. Because if you're like me, you get feeling better. You ain't going to want to do this stuff. I wouldn't. They found me a sponsor. They wouldn't let me pick a sponsor. They had more sense than I did. They told me I'd find somebody that I'd tell how to operate this program. They were right. I would have. But they made me so mad they gave me a man, and he was younger than I was. He's also sober than I was, too. And that man guided me through the first part of my recovery for the first year. He moved out of town, and then I needed another sponsor. And guys, don't do like me. If something happens and your sponsor has to go somewhere, moves, or dies, do not sit around waiting to pick out somebody to replace that man you had. Nobody ever will be able to. Find you another man to help you in his way. Don't wait. I damn near got loaded looking for another sponsor. Kind of got on through that. Yes, I need to. Am I right? Told y'all I wouldn't have. Anyhow, I finally got another sponsor, and he swelled my ego up because the night I asked him in the Biscayne, Randy knows where that was, place is over there, and he said, well, I was going to ask you to be mine. Oh, boy, I just swelled up like a big old rosebud then, you know. Get them suspenders out there. But that man was in my life for a couple of 3 years, and I really needed him. He had a way with words. He could enter my brain. He knew what was going on with me. Nobody had ever been able to do that. I'd say yes, he'd say I was saying no. You know, he knew me that well. And something happened in his life. He's one of those guys that I made amends to tonight. He'd had some struggles in Vietnam, and a lot of stuff went on in his life over there. And he's made a choice not to be in Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. As far as I know, he's sober. I've literally begged him to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I couldn't stay sober without him. But God was just making something better in my life for me. I got another sponsor, a man I've been running into all over the state of Georgia and different places in AA. Everywhere I'd go, there he'd be. Y'all ever have things like that happen? I mean, I'd go off out of town, there he'd be. I'd go over here, there he'd be. We'd always talk, seem to be getting along. Finally, I said, you know, I'd have got sick again because I wouldn't ask nobody to be my sponsor. And then I wasn't supposed to, you know, newcomers, I couldn't tell. Finally, I said, Jimmy, how about being my sponsor? He said, I'd love to. And we've had a relationship that's continued wonderfully for several years, and we do a lot together in AA. It's the greatest relationship I've ever had with another man that I ever know, including my father. I wish I could say different, that I had a wonderful relationship with my father, but I didn't. Guys, there's a lot that's went on in my life and a lot that I could tell you, but I want to share a few things that are up to date a little bit with you. Let you know that, I was talking about that sponsor, and we managed to get to the international the other year in 2000 up in Minnesota. Me and him, he couldn't see, and I was his CNI sponsor, he said, at that time. And I run into Tommy Morgan up there somewhere, wherever Tommy was at. He was up there. Two or three folks run into up there. You know, we had 70,000 in the opening meeting up there, and you're talking about some power and magic in the rooms. And later on, at the end of May, me and Jimmy have got a little AA trip planned. We do a lot of AA planning, and Nothing don't happen. We're going to New York City to see World Services. We're going on Friday to a meeting there in World Services. Saturday we're going to Lois's picnic at Stepping Stones. We're going to go over to East Dorset to the Wilson House. And back over to Akron to Founders Day. And you see that guy that used to live in the bushes out there? That guy that couldn't hold a job. That guy that couldn't ask for help, and that guy that ruined and wrecked two families. That's the guy that's doing that today. And it's all because of you people. A couple of years ago, my parents, they saw me go through 6.5 years of sobriety. God blessed them, and I lost them both real close together. And I was able to be there for them down to the last second, you know, and it may not mean much to you, but it means a lot to me. I was the guy they could never find when they needed help. I was the guy that if they found him, he was in no condition to help them. And I was the guy that always went over there wanting for himself. And I was the guy that they gave to and took stuff away from themselves to give to that son. When my father passed away, he'd been in a coma in the hospital for 3 days, and the doctor said, "We don't know why he's alive." And I said, "I know, because he's waiting on my older sister to get there." And she got there, and I told her, I said, "I'm going out to smoke, but I think things are getting close." And you holler out this window, I opened the window and said, "You holler out here and tip me if anything changes." And I got down there, and I was smoking, and she did. And I went back up, and I was able to stand there and hold my daddy's hands, and he opened his eyes. And he looked at me. He looked at this drunk. And he couldn't talk, but I knew he knew who I was. And I said, "Daddy, go on home. Just go on home." And guys, he looked up and he saw something we ain't seen yet. And a peace came over him, and you can believe it or not, it's up to you. I know. With this drunk boy holding his hand, the angels came and took him home. I can't do that. You do that. You give me the strength to be a human being today. On my own, I'm still nothing. My aftercare counselor gave me permission to cry, and by George, I'm glad of it. If you need permission, you got it. Cry. You know, it's things like that that make this program what it is. Because we're not supposed to be able to do that stuff. You know, it's Saturday night and every one of us is supposed to be drunk and fighting right now. And the ones that ain't drunk and fighting is out drunk and stealing. You know, that's what we're supposed to be doing. I ain't supposed to be up here in no suit and tie. That's true, though, I ain't. But this place is so special to me. There was no way. I talked to Jimmy. I've been thinking. I said, "Should I wear a coat and tie? Should I wear a coat and tie? Should I wear a coat and tie?" And any time I start thinking about things, it sounds to me like my higher power sponsor is trying to talk to me. So I piddled with that and piddled with that and piddled with that. And finally I said, "Well, when all else fails, what are you supposed to do? Call your sponsor." God knows why we fight such stuff as that. So I called Jimmy and I said, "Jimmy, reckon I ought to wear a coat and tie?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Thank you, bye." Yeah. Immediately wanted to know why in the world did I call him, because I was about to talk myself out of wearing one. But once I done called him, see, I can't get out of it. That's what I have to be careful of, guys, is living in my own thinking. My thinking's a lot cleaner and a lot better than it used to be. It is far from perfect. Far from perfect. I know today what to do. I can no longer sit and say, "Well, I didn't know." You know, the judge told me ignorance of law is no excuse. I didn't know. You know. And today y'all won't let me get by with that either. Today I know whether whatever I'm doing benefits one or the other, benefits either my recovery, or it benefits my disease. There's no in-between. There's no pulling the wool over my eyes. I can't hide behind that lie anymore that I did it because I'm a drunk. You know, I may do it. I may try to get away with it. But it don't work. I've often sat out there on Saturday night and said, you know, I'd like to be up there. I'm still scared right now, guys. I don't know why. Maybe my own insecurities, maybe my own whatevers. But I know I'm going to be okay. I know I'm going to be okay and that you're not going to run me off. I know I'm going to be okay and I'm not going to have to take that first drink. And I know I'm going to be okay and I'm going to be lovable and I'm going to be able to love other people. I'm blessed with spending a lot of time in this program now, working this field. And boy, that's changed since I came around. It's I just do things real strange now, you know. But I say, okay, whatever. And then I tell them what I know. Because you see, I ain't got anything but my experience. And it don't matter how many people with how many damn bunches of letters behind their name come in and say, well, we think this will work. I know this will work. You see, I know this will work. Because it's brought a guy who would be laying in the bushes out there drunk inside this building to stand in front of 300 and something men and let you know a little bit about me. That scared little boy who never wanted to admit he was ever afraid of anything can stand up here tonight and let you know, yep, I got a little fear. But you know it's a lot less than it was. And it's all because of you people and what you shared with me. Directions need to be followed. I don't know any other way. Step one, I'm powerless. And then I got to remember that dash in there. A lot of times I drift away from that dash. That dash says, stop. I can hear that English teacher now. Stop. Brand new thought coming, totally separate from this other one over here. Some of y'all remember English, too, don't you? The second part of step one, that our lives had become unmanageable. I got to find a manager. And it's got to be a manager other than me. And my sponsor's not going to manage my life. But my higher power's been doing a dead gum good job for a pretty good while. The decisions I make today are just a little bit better than they used to be. Thank you for your sharing this morning, Les. I really appreciate your honesty. I could tell that man's been sponsored by people out of this book right here. And I do appreciate it. You know, guys, I gotta tell you, the strangest of things, and then I'm going to finish up here. I don't know why I've waited to the end of this thing to tell you this story. I've gotten that backwards, but that's the way I am. I was thinking, what could I tell you? And, you know, and I said, well, I've heard all these jokes and these jokes and these jokes. So I decided to tell you this joke, and then I'll tell you why. There was a little donkey that walked back into the barn over in foreign country a long, long time ago, and he walked in and all the other animals were in there, and that little donkey said, man, I'm so special, y'all just wouldn't believe it. And they said, what do you mean, what do you mean? He said, oh, come walking into town, said these people, they just laid these palm fronds down on the ground for me to walk on. Said they were bowing down on the side. Said they were just praising me and telling me how wonderful I was. And there's a wise old owl sitting back up in the corner of the barn over there, and he looked down and he said, fool, you just the ass that carries a message. Let us not ever forget that we're just the ass that carries a message. About a week ago, I was reading my morning thing and let me come back to that. This morning, in my little, I read a little Daily Bread. Don't mind telling you. I mean, I read outside literature. Okay? Don't read it in the room.
Kill him, ain't it? Kill him. You won't do right.
Anyway, you would not believe what that morning reading was about. I don't believe in coincidences today, guys. That morning reading was about a donkey. Y'all know about the donkey, don't you? Is that a coincidence? I tend to think not. About a week ago, I was reading something, and I think this just means a whole lot to us in this program. Those who are lost need someone to show them the way. Guys, thank you for showing me the way. Thank you for giving me you and letting me live off you and letting you love me until I could begin to find a way to sort of love myself. Because I'm going to borrow this from Pat R. from the Houston group. I like me best when I'm with you. Thank you.